This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more details.
Hi, this is Garrett Wong. I played Ensign Harry Kim on Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host, Suzanne Williamson, and with me, as always, are...
Zachary Frueling and...
Kay Shaw.
Well, today, we're going to talk about Voyager, but we're not going to talk about Voyager the show. We're going to talk about Voyager the ship.
I would have to say, hands down, my favorite thing about Voyager are those pivoting warp nacelles. I don't know how practical they are, they just look freaking awesome.
Yeah, they do look really cool. Do we know whether they serve, like, a specific purpose? Are they like that for a reason, or did they just make them like that to look cool?
They seem wildly impractical. Like, what happens if you forget your starship lube and they get stuck? In the Delta Quadrant, there's no space garage to take your starship in for a starship lube and tune. So I vote impractical myself.
It is definitely just for the cool factor.
Yeah, they do look awesome, though.
Do you think that the artificial gravity goes with it? So if, like, there's some dude working in the nacelles and the nacelles go up, is he standing at an angle now?
Is anybody even in those?
I don't think anybody's in the nacelles, are they?
No, wouldn't they get burned up?
Well, they have to do maintenance sometimes, right?
Yeah, but I don't think they pivot them whilst they're maintaining them.
No, they'd be flat.
Well, that's true, I guess.
They'd be flat.
And don't they have to be either in, for want of a better word, dry dock or equivalent to do it?
Or landed on a planet.
Yeah. Or landed.
To do maintenance on the nacelles?
Yeah.
They can't just turn them off?
Do they need the nacelles for impulse drive?
No.
Okay, so then they could do it during impulse drive.
But where is the impulse drive on Voyager? Like, on the Enterprise-D, there was the little impulse generator on the back of the saucer section, right? But where is the impulse generator on Voyager? How do we not know this?
Maybe it's on the back by the shuttle bay.
Maybe.
To kind of propel it along.
Possibly.
Quick, everyone find a picture of Voyager and see if we can find it.
It doesn't have to be on the saucer section because the ship doesn't separate. That's why in the Enterprise-D it's on the saucer. I mean, it is on the original Enterprise as well.
I don't know.
It is in the reboot, because that big bar thing on the back of the saucer section in the reboot is the impulse drive.
I think it's actually those little red things that you see that on the little arms that hold the nacelles.
Oh, is it?
They're like these two little pods next to the actual nacelles on the little arms that hold the nacelles, and they're glowing red on the back of the ship.
Right. So somebody could blow the nacelles off and they'd have no, like, drive whatsoever. We're going to have to scour the show now for instances where they're using impulse drive only.
Well, you want to see it, like, when they actually kick it into gear, yeah. So you can see it start to glow and push the ship, right?
Yeah.
The warp core on Voyager has to be, like, tiny, itsy-bitsy compared to the warp core on the Enterprise-D, though, right? The Voyager's, like, half as tall.
And it looks like a pencil. Yes.
Yeah. Because how many decks does the Enterprise-D have?
A lot.
I thought it was 42. Isn't it 42? I had the Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual when I was a kid. I think it's 42.
Okay. It's almost a third of that then, isn't it? Because Voyager has 15.
Voyager's 15, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because if you do the math, let's look at this because something's not adding up. I'm serious. I actually wrote down the specs of Voyager before we started recording. And so I've got Voyager as the length is 1,125 feet and the width is 381 feet. Okay, I guess I don't have the height.
Yeah, there's no height.
I just have length and the width. I couldn't find the height.
Okay.
Okay, so the Enterprise-D has 42 decks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it has a height of 640.6 feet. So let me whip out the calculator.
Again?
Yeah, this is a calculator-based episode of To the Journey. Okay, so this is really weird. On the Enterprise D, if it is 640.6 feet tall, the average size of the decks would be 15.25 feet. Those are humongous decks.
They're not that tall. So they must not all
be the same. What is in between all those decks? But that's a lot of Jeffrey's tubes to fill up that space.
Well, I was going to say, you have to leave room for Jeffrey's tubes.
Yeah.
They could have, like, Jeffrey's bowling alleys with all that extra space.
Well, you also have to have pipes for, like, you know, water. Well, not really water, but sewage.
Jeffrey's pipes. Who is Jeffrey anyway?
He's the guy that made the pipe.
No, it's named after Matt Jeffries, right?
Is it?
Yeah, it's actually named after someone.
Oh, okay.
Okie dokie then.
No, they don't really explain who it's named after in universe.
No.
Yeah, that's what we were looking for.
We need to know who Jeffrey is. Quick, Google who is Jeffrey.
And why does he have a tube?
I know we're supposed to be talking about Voyager, but I can't help talking about the Enterprise D here because that's the only one we have some data for. So if you take the height of the Enterprise, divide it by the number of decks, you end up with an average deck height of 15 feet. They could have twice as many decks on that ship because they only need like a ceiling height of 8 feet. So they could have, what, 84 decks if they wanted to?
But then when Mr. Hom visits, he'd bang his head on the ceiling.
That's true.
Mr. Hom!
They need at least like 10 feet for Mr. Hom. Come on.
It's all extra for Mr. Hom.
And they don't have 8-foot ceilings. They're more like 10 feet, but they're not 15 feet.
No.
Okay, so I did the math, and it turns out that if you take 15 decks by an average height of 15 feet per deck, we got that from the Enterprise D by analogy, Voyager should be about 225 feet tall.
Okay.
I don't know how tall that is.
That's about as tall as about a 20-story building?
Well, the stories are probably about the same as the decks then. So that makes sense.
And if we look at the rest of the specifications, that kind of makes sense. So if the length is 1,125 feet and the width is 381 feet, and because Voyager's pretty flat, it's not like a tall starship like the Enterprise D. It doesn't have that long neck on it. So it should be less, the height should be less than that. And that kind of works out. So 225 feet is less than that. I think we're onto something here.
But because this is something I've never really understood about how the decks work. And this is probably because I'm not as much of a starship junkie as a lot of people, but
I am not either.
Engineering, for example, is that like two decks high?
That is two levels, yes.
Yeah. And the same for like the cargo bays and stuff.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
What about the holodecks?
Well, that was my next question. The holodecks like two decks high as well, because they're quite high, aren't they?
Well, they're not two 15-foot decks, because that would be massive.
When the hole gets blown in the holodeck in The Killing Game, parts one and two, you see it's gigantic and enormous, so it has to be at least two decks.
Well, yeah, because you see how much bigger it goes when they walk in from the corridor, don't you? It's a lot higher.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's two decks as well. So now we have to think of all the things and see if we can fit them in. There must be a plan somewhere with it all on.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Well, that's the thing about Voyager that never, it just doesn't add up to me, because on the inside, they're really kind of, there's no difference in scale. It looks pretty similar on the interior of Voyager as it did on the Next Generation. And yet Voyager is supposed to be a lean, mean, smaller kind of ship. And yet there's a lot of stuff they pack into Voyager.
They needed a lot of space for all of Chakotay's whittling materials.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if he's going to keep building shuttlecrafts and torpedoes, he needs a lot of materials.
I did read that there were 257 rooms on Voyager. And so we can start like checking things off the list. There's all the crew quarters, and then there's, you know, astrometrics and the bridge. And you can start checking things off. I wonder how many rooms you're left over with, like how many rooms are unaccounted for in Voyager and what is in those rooms.
Well, they only have like two cargo bays, don't they? And I'm sure like only on two. Next Gen and stuff, we hear them go, oh, cargo bay 12 and stuff like that. So I think they have way less of that type of thing.
Yeah.
And there are a lot less crew quarters as well, because there are a lot fewer crew.
See, this is the surface area to volume problem. So Voyager's only half as big, but it has a smaller fraction of the volume, right?
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. But then they only have, like, say, they have the mess hall. That's, like, the only kind of real proper big communal area. And that's only a fraction of the size of, say, 10 forward, which I'm guessing is about the equivalent communal area you've got.
That is the old Next Generation set for, isn't that the same set? Isn't that the set they use for 10 forward for the Next Generation?
Well, it must only be a bit of it.
Yeah.
It's a quarter.
Yeah, they probably use some of the same furniture and stuff.
Like the doors. I want to say they used the doors and redressed them or something.
They changed the windows.
Yes. The mess hall's kind of cool, though. I like it. I like the fact that they have this nice little communal space. It's a nice idea.
I think that's one of the big differences between Voyager and the Enterprise-D, though, right? The Enterprise-D is like a floating city ship in space, right? It's massive. It's 1,000 people. It's a community. With Voyager, it's only supposed to have a crew of about 140, so they don't really need a social place because that's not its mission. It's not a deep space ship that's going to be out there, you know, for, you know, 10 years at a time away from star bases. It's not a city, and it doesn't need all the amenities that you need on the Enterprise-D. So, hence, no barber, no dentist. Sorry, Bruce Lish. But I guess it's interesting. This was one of the cool changes about Voyager. Once Voyager gets lost in the Delta Quadrant, they need a place to socialize because they're stuck with each other. Okay, so what other things is Voyager missing? It's a pretty small ship. It doesn't have all the room for the stuff you get on the Enterprise-D. Like, what?
The Enterprise-D has an arboretum.
You think that's a lot of extra space? If you have room for an arboretum, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, they have an aeroponics bay or hydroponics bay, but they don't have an arboretum.
Well, they had to make the aeroponics bay, right? Voyager didn't come with an aeroponics bay.
That was one of the cargo bays, and they repurposed it.
So they end up with no cargo bays.
There's still a cargo bay that Chakotay hides his cider in.
Are there three, then?
There might have been, to start with.
See, where are there room for three cargo bays on a ship as small as Voyager?
They make one into, like, Seven's regeneration area.
Well, she's only got a corner of it. She's not taking over the whole thing. Okay. She's that corner.
Do they have three? I'm hearing myself going cargo bay three and thinking that's something they said. I don't know. That could have been next gen. Who knows?
Well, I think there's two really interesting related facets here. One is that there's some things on Voyager that just don't make sense. There's not enough room for all the stuff that they want to put in Voyager. And it just the math just doesn't kind of add up in my mind. And then there's all this cool kludgy kind of stuff they did to customize Voyager once they're in the Delta Quadrant. Right? They turn one of the cargo bays into the aeroponics bay. They turn the captain's mess into a mess hall. They get the astrometrics lab. They eventually build the Delta Flyer. They get Borg technology. It is one kludgy, greebly ship at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think it is. I would have liked to have seen more, though. I'd have liked to see it look different on the outside. Because it never really looks different on the outside.
Yeah, a little cobbled together.
Just that they get, like, different bits that they add on. And we know, like you've just said, that they do change some stuff and they add some technology. But you don't really see that visually on the outside of the ship. And it would have been cool if we'd seen it getting a bit more.
What would you like to see? Like little Borg tubes coming out of the warp core? Yeah. Like, what do you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That would have been cool.
Like if they had to patch the ship with some metal from some another ship or
yes,
something.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
You know, get a
that's
Kazon,
the kind of thing.
Kazon hull area over here.
See the rivets on there and everything. That would be cool.
What about Species 8472 bioships? Like, do you think they take some of the bioship and just like graft it on there like a skin graft?
I don't know that would work. They could probably use that on the bioneural circuitry.
Gel packs.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you think that if they did that, okay, so here's my thought experiment. If they took the bioship's material from Species 8472, grafted it onto Voyager, would the bioneural gel packs all of a sudden be able to feel like Data getting skin grafted on in First Contact?
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
That'd be a cool science fiction episode, wouldn't it?
You'd have to blow on it and see how the bioneural gel packs reacted.
You can't blow on things in space.
And then how would the cheese react with it after that?
Mm, yeah.
I love the idea of Voyager getting goosebumps. That cracks me up. But
I know you can't actually do that. But
like the whole ship gets goosebumps. The hull, the skin of the
ends
ship.
Up looking like a Dalek.
Exterminate. Exterminate.
Well, if you graft enough Borg technology on there, it might start getting a bit Dalek-y.
I could see that.
Going on to the bioneural gel packs, actually. It's a cool idea. I do like the idea. And they come up with a reasonable kind of explanation for it, which is, oh, it transmits data so much faster, rah, rah, rah. But from where I'm sitting, from a writer's room perspective, they just did that so that then they could infect Voyager with viruses, didn't they?
With cheese. It was all about the cheese.
They did.
No. I think they wanted to show that in the 24th century, computers still haven't caught up to neurons and neural stuff in terms of processing power and raw ability.
Yeah.
Technology still hasn't caught up with our brains.
But what if it went all Skynet on them? Because, I mean, this was new technology. What if it totally went Skynet and killed everybody and just took over?
True. You got to think they were probably developing it for a while, though. I don't think they just kind of came up with it and then threw it on there.
No, they had to socialize them. They're like little kittens. You have to socialize them when you first turn them on. Socialize the gel packs. Yeah.
But it is quite an interesting idea that they can get these diseases and then they can infect the ship. I like that.
But then it was a struggle because there were no replacements. And they couldn't just, you know, replicate a replacement. But they never dealt with that.
So you guys remember that episode, Good Shepherd, where Janeway, you know, kind of takes the crew. They don't fit in on Voyager. They're black sheep. They're not doing their mm-hmm. jobs well. They're not involved. And she takes them on. That episode. Do you guys think that there is like a black sheep neural gel pack that doesn't fit in with the rest of the gel packs? And it's in charge of the stuff down in the lower decks. And he hangs out with Mortimer, Heron down there in the bottom of the ship.
Yes. That's totally legit.
So he gets to go on an away mission, like they disconnect him, take him on a trip, talk nice to him, and then, you know, his attitude improves, and then he's part of the rest of the crew, the rest of the gel packs.
Yeah, persuade him not to talk down all the rest of the gel packs.
Good gel pack. Sweet gel pack.
Fluffy
have a
gel
treat,
pack.
Gel pack.
You must pat it, and you must hug it, and tell it that it's a good gel pack.
I will not.
I will feed the gel pack.
I will feed it.
Well, that is another question. If it's bioneural, it needs to survive, right? What do these neural gel packs live on if they're alive?
Are they alive to that extent?
Even if that's true, though, I mean, you have to nourish those biological bits, right? How do the neural gel packs consume energy? How do they consume nutrients? How do they thrive?
What about like those little self-contained like ecosystem type things? Like those little glass orbs you can get that
like
have the water? And yeah, I mean, it's all sealed.
So you're saying the neural gel packs are a self-sustaining terrarium-like ecosystem.
Exactly.
A neural terrarium.
Yes, I am down with that.
I love the idea of a neural terrarium.
It's the only thing that makes sense to me. Because it's not like, you know, somebody goes along and is putting a hypo spray up to each one to give them nutrients every month or whatever.
Yeah, I love the idea they have to feed the gel packs, yeah. So by analogy then, if the gel packs have to consume nutrients, do you picture like the little gel packs going, feed me Tuvok, feed me Tuvok?
I got in my brain the fly, the Vincent Price fly. Help me, help me. That's just what I was thinking about. Like, oh gosh, they're like the fly.
I think there's a missed opportunity on Voyager to explore the consciousness of the neural gel packs. The gel packs must have a rich daydreaming life because they can't do anything else. They can't go anywhere except where Voyager goes. So they must just, you know, daydream the day away.
I don't
away.
Think they're conscious.
So they're just like biological relays, you know, processing information, flipping
yeah.
switches. But it's all biomechanical. It's not actually neural in the sense of, you know, like we think of neurons, like brain stuff that gives rise to consciousness.
Well, it's neural because I think as a network they're connected into
mm-hmm. just the way it's connected.
A brain-like structure, but I don't think they have a consciousness.
But it's no more conscious than an isolinear chip.
I think if they were starting to have a consciousness, we'd have to start asking some serious questions about enslavement. But
well, why couldn't they have a consciousness? Because the doctor ended up, you know,
yeah,
as his own person, more or less. Why not the gel packs?
Can't you picture Kes being as sympathetic and as
gel
caring of a character
rights.
She is? Yeah, gel pack rights. Carrying a sign around, you know, fair pay for gel packs. Yeah.
They had to go through some pretty rubbish stuff. I mean, they get infected in macrocosm, right? They're just full of, like, green goo and...
They get infected. They get, like, the positronic fleas go after them.
They do get the positronic fleas, yeah.
The cheese, of course.
You really have to steam clean the carpet in the corridors to get rid of those things. I don't know what to say about the gel packs in all seriousness. We've been making some gel pack jokes, but it's a cool idea. I mean, it's a way of making this tiny little ship be not just a tiny little ship that can maneuver, but it's a smarter ship than the Enterprise D.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely faster. And I mean, it's faster not just in processing information, but it's obviously faster as well.
Mm-hmm.
That scene at the beginning of Encounter at Farpoint would have been a lot more challenging for Q with Voyager. warp 9.975.
Well, I'm trying to understand exactly how much faster warp 9.975 is than the top cruising speed of the Enterprise D, which is 9.6, yeah. Right? Isn't that right? And so, but it's a logarithmic scale.
It's a lot faster.
So,
yeah.
So it's a lot faster, even though it's not, it's only a small decimal number, but it's a logarithmic scale. So it's a lot faster than 9.6, even though it's only 9.975.
I think 9.975 is like the theoretical limit, isn't it?
No, warp 10 is the theoretical. You can't go warp 10. You can go anything up to warp 10.
Yes, but we don't talk about that.
You just turn into a lizard.
You do turn into a lizard.
Why can't you go faster than warp 9.975?
Because you turn,
because
into,
you'll
a
turn into a lizard.
No, only if you go warp 10. What if you go warp 9.976?
Then you just become half a lizard.
You don't get lizards at warp 9.976.
Because you're getting too close and it's dangerous.
Or you just get a forked tongue, maybe.
Do not approach the lizard threshold. But a bump.
I am trying to find a diagram depicting the logarithmic scale of warp speeds in Star Trek, and that is the nerdiest thing I have ever Googled.
No, that is not the nerdiest thing you've ever Googled. Stop pretending.
Are you going to make a Venn diagram out of this?
That's just like a normal Friday's Googling, that is. No, I get what you're saying, that they could go like warp 9.976 or whatever, but I think 9.975 is effectively their way of saying maximum, because they don't want to be going, oh, we're at warp 9.999999999999.
Okay, if when they built the Enterprise D and they said, okay, well, 9.6, let's call that maximum. But when they build Voyager, it's a little faster, and now that's the new maximum. That's a pretty meaningless maximum, because they're just going to build a better ship eventually.
Every little bit help.
Mr. Paris, engage course warp 9.9 recurring.
I am actually having a hard time finding a decent visual logarithmic representation of the warp scale.
I am shocked. That is your project for this weekend.
I can't believe no one's done this.
You know what that means? You are geekier than the majority of Trekkies.
Which I didn't think was possible, but yes, yes.
Nope, but apparently it is.
It has happened.
Yeah, we try to be data-driven onto the journey, sure. Well, the Enterprise D occasionally was data driven, but we tend to be data driven in the difference.
Yes.
Okay, so I found one. This is an interesting diagram because it shows the old warp scale they used in the original Star Trek and the new warp scale that they used from the Next Generation on. And I'm trying to describe it because I know you listeners can't see it, but it's got this kind of, it's not a smooth, like steady acceleration curve. Like there's a huge spike from warp 1 to warp 2 to warp 3. Then it kind of levels out between warp 3 and warp 8. Then starting at like warp 9.6 is this radical spike upwards. Mm. And that leads me to think it's not purely logarithmic either, that they're just making this up.
What do you mean they're just making this up? This is Star Trek. None of it's made up. It's all factual.
Warp drive is real.
It's all factual. It just hasn't happened yet. This is what I tend to argue with people. No. Now, here we go. Since we're data-driven, onto the journey.
You have the data?
Voyager has a Class 9 warp drive, which was developed for the Intrepid class. There you go. The warp drive allowed the starship to achieve the sustainable cruise velocity of 9.975. The warp core has a triolic input manifold.
Not triolic.
This system was designed to provide a maximum output of 4,000 teradynes per second.
Aren't triolic waves hazardous to living tissue? Didn't we learn that in an episode of The Next Generation? Times arrow, I believe.
No, it's not triolic. It's tricyclic.
Triolic, tricyclic, tomato, tomato.
Oh, in that case, the warp core is totally safe. It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's tricyclic, not
trial. It's all good.
All is well.
It's all good.
It's fine.
Leave your radiation suit in your quarters.
And the reaction chamber is equipped with a compositor, which allows recrystallization of the dilithium. So there.
Woohoo!
4,000 teradynes per second. Wow.
What is a dyne?
I have no idea. It's
such that you can have teradynes.
That's a lot of pterodactyls.
It's a measurement that they made up for the purposes of measuring the output of warp cores. Let's not have another Wrenchens incident.
Don't they measure warp energy in like Cochrane's?
Cochrane. But this is the energy output.
So what's a Cochrane versus a dyne?
Is that not to do with the actual warping effect rather than the output of energy?
Maybe. I have no idea.
I'm making this up on the fly, but I'm impressed because I sound like I know what I'm talking about. I have no idea, but apparently teradynes is totally a thing.
So it goes without saying that Voyager is a pretty souped up starship. I mean, it's little, it's lean, it's mean, it's maneuverable, but it's not as massive as the Enterprise D, but it's smarter and it's faster and it's pretty badass.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why it got sent on this mission, because obviously they needed something that could actually negotiate the Badlands.
It needed to be maneuverable. It had to be a small starship.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maneuverable and also quick to react, because they've got to try and avoid all those plasma storms.
But the way you described Voyager, smaller, smarter, totally badass, also describes her captain perfectly.
Yes. Smaller, smarter, and totally badass.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
So I've got a different question for you guys. What are your thoughts on calling Voyager just plain Voyager, or calling it the Voyager, like Tom Paris does in the episode Parallax? Is it properly Voyager or the Voyager?
It's Voyager.
They call the Enterprise the Enterprise, so I think it's interesting that they don't with Voyager.
But they don't do that in the TV show Enterprise. They could just call it Enterprise.
Yeah, but do they refer to the ship as Enterprise, or do they call it the Enterprise? I don't remember.
No, in Enterprise, they just call it Enterprise.
Do they?
Like, we're beaming back to Enterprise, yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
And it always struck me as wrong, because I've always heard it as the Enterprise, the Defiant.
Yeah.
I don't like throwing that extra word in there. It's not necessary. It's Voyager.
Yeah, the Voyager sounds really wrong.
It does.
It sounds too proper.
Just because we're not used to hearing it.
But what accounts for the difference? Like, why shouldn't we just call it the Defiant? Let's go get on board Defiant.
Yeah, but they never say that.
So why are they different?
I don't know.
Because they are.
And I have thought about this before, and I don't think there's any clear reason why. But they say the Starship Enterprise. You would say the Starship Voyager if you were saying that.
Yeah, you'd say the Starship Voyager.
Yeah, if you
right?
throw yeah. Starship in front of it, yeah. then the Starship Voyager. But if you're just talking about Voyager, it's just Voyager.
Unless you're saying it's the smarter, faster, more badass starship, then you'd say the.
Yeah, but you need prefixes.
Yeah.
If you're going to do that. But I don't know why they did that. Whether that was a conscious thing or whether that just ended up happening, I don't know.
It might have just happened organically. I have no idea.
Yeah. Because even other ships that they run into, like the Equinox, they say the Equinox, don't they?
They do.
Yes, they do.
So it's obviously a very specific Voyager thing, which is weird.
And when the doctor goes through the communication system and goes to that other ship, they call it the Prometheus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you also get the relativity, the time ship relativity.
The time ship relativity.
Yeah. But they would say just the relativity as well.
Yeah, they wouldn't just say relativity. We
may be trying to analyze something that doesn't really have an answer.
Well, if you think of it in like a neighborhood or a city, you don't say, I live in the Chicago or I live in the New York. And really, Voyager is home to these people. It's not just a ship, it's home. So it's Voyager.
And that would make sense if they didn't do it to begin with, but they did it later on. But they do it right from the beginning.
I'm just trying to justify it here. I like that explanation.
I know you're
I'm sticking with it.
I think it makes sense. Does it change how we think about the ship? Do we think about the ship differently because we just call it Voyager rather than calling it the Voyager?
No, totally.
I think so.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Absolutely. I think it's more like a first name, like you're talking to your best friend, yeah. Like Voyager. It becomes a character with a personality.
It is its own character.
Definitely. I feel like Voyager is more of a character in the show than the ships are in any of the other shows. I know people get very attached to the ships. Definitely feels like a part of the crew.
So Voyager's kind of like a pet name, is what you're saying.
Like Snookums?
The USS Snookums?
I've just got this vision now of Janeway there. Who's a good Voyager? Who's a good girl?
Well, she liked to, you know, stroke the halls and everything.
So Tom Paris would be like, who's a good girl? You want to go for a ride? Let's go.
maybe Snookums could have been an alternate name for the Doctor as well.
Snookums.
Joe Snookums.
Snookums Van Gogh.
Since we've just mentioned the Doctor, actually, we should talk a little bit about sickbay. I think sickbay is really interesting, actually, in Voyager, because I think because of the nature of the Doctor early on, when he can't actually leave, I think we see a lot more of it than we do in the other shows. I mean, we see sickbay in the other shows, but I feel like we see it more.
I've got a question about sickbay, actually. What is the purpose of those orange lights where the biobed is? Like, is it just mood lighting? You know what I'm talking about? The orange lights on the wall.
Yeah.
The orange wall.
Are they sensors?
I don't know.
Could be.
Or do they generate, like, the force fields when they need force fields?
Or are they just like 24th century high efficiency LED lighting?
They just look cool. Maybe, that's all.
Maybe they just pimp my sick bay.
Well, okay, so this is an interesting question. What else on Voyager is a little weird? So, like, the orange wall in sickbay, I look at that every time, and as cool as sickbay looks, I kind of go, what purpose does this serve? I would never design something this way. So, are there other things in Voyager that just kind of don't make sense to you guys?
Yes. Every time they go to red alert, all the lights go down. I'm sorry, red alert, emergency situation, those lights need to be up, folks. Come on, get with it. You need to see what you're doing.
I always wondered whether or not that wasn't so that they could see the panels more clearly.
But it doesn't seem like they can, because everybody's like cloaked in darkness, and the panels don't really give off much light.
And like in an emergency, if the ship is being boarded or something, and Tuvok's like, Harry, throw me a phaser, and then he can't see it, and he misses.
And he hits him in the head.
It's mood lighting.
Okay, so the seemingly backwards red alert illumination level, that doesn't make sense to Suzanne. How about you, Kay? Is there something that doesn't make total sense to you?
Well, one thing that always bugged me was how they have all this rationing. So actually two things about rationing in general, but they have obviously energy conservation issues because of the fact that they don't know when they're going to be able to renew their energy reserves.
Oh yeah.
So the first question is, when they're on all of this energy rationing, how come they can still use the holodeck? And I know that they come up with some nonsense excuse about, oh, well, it's on a completely different energy system. We can't use the energy from the holodeck. But that doesn't make sense because it's still going to be energy from the warp core ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Why couldn't they find a way to rewire that energy to where they needed it instead of the holodeck, other than just because they wanted to tell stories in the holodeck?
Yeah, which is obviously the reason. So... Mm-hmm. I was fine with them doing that and them saying, oh, we want to come up with a way to still be able to use the holodeck because we still want to be able to do our holodeck stories. And I'm cool with that because I like holodeck stories, but I wish they'd managed to come up with something better because I think it's a bit loose and a bit nonsense.
Yeah, really. A little.
And the other thing is the fact that we have this rationing system where they're rationed on how much they can use the replicator. But we never really explain how the rationing system works. Like, how much is something worth? Like, what's a replicator rationed? What is it? What is that monetary value or is it energy value? And
like, are different things worth different amounts? Like,
yeah.
Are you saying like a big, juicy, fat bacon cheeseburger would be worth more than like a carrot?
Yeah, and I've kind of always assumed that it must be based on the amount of energy it uses to produce it. Mm-hmm. But then the interesting thing is that we never really hear an explanation in Star Trek of how you know how much energy something takes to produce from the replicator, and it's probably not really related to its monetary value. It's probably related to the complexity of its structure or something, but how you know how much energy something takes to produce, I have no idea. So that's probably my other thing. I would have liked to have seen a bit more explanation of how that worked. What they have replicator rations, but how much do they get, and what does that theoretically allow them to make? Because we never really get a sense of how much they can get from the replicator in what period of time for the rations that they get. Does everybody get the same? Does Captain Janeway get more? Or I don't know. Inquiring minds need to know.
It's handed out by your rank.
Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about things on Voyager that may or may not add up in our minds, what do you guys think of the bridge on Voyager, especially the two... not the two captain's chairs, but the captain's chair and the first officer's chair kind of being equal to each other, more or less. And maybe the overall design of the bridge in general. One thing that just never made sense to me at all about the design of the bridges on Star Trek, it seems wildly impractical, is all the people behind the captain. So the captain's constantly having to like look over her shoulder and go, sorry, what'd you say, Tuvok? What'd you say, Harry?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a hangover from the original series, because in the original
series... No, it totally is. Yeah, it's a Star Trek thing, but...
People just around the edges, didn't they? Obviously not at the front where the view screen is, but just like around, I guess.
Well, Uhura was right behind Kirk.
Yes, she was, yeah.
Yeah.
And Spock's kind of like to the side, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
But you'd think you'd want to put the captain like totally in the back so the captain can see everything, kind of like they do in like the Apollo, you know, command center, you know, with the guy in charge being in the back, kind of looking at everyone down below doing all the work.
Making sure you're pushing the right buttons.
Kind of, you get it on Deep Space Nine, right? That's basically Commander Sisko's office on Deep Space Nine, or Gul Dukat's office on this Cardassian design on Deep Space Nine, overlooking all the people, all the minions doing the work.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of like the captain being in the middle, though. It feels very... I get what you're saying about the Apollo command center, but it feels more command center-y to me to have them in the center.
It's more commanding, maybe.
Yeah. And I like the fact that... I really like the fact that in Voyager, we get a return to having the stations at the side as well, because we don't have that in Next Gen. All mm-hmm. the stations are at the back in Next Gen, and then you've got, like, the panel behind.
And they're literally, like, facing the back wall.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird, actually.
Exactly.
Can't see, you know, if there's something interesting on the view screen, you're totally going to miss it in Next Gen.
But at least in Voyager, we have, like, this...
I missed it again!
We have the science station to one side, don't we?
Mm-hmm. And engineering on the other side.
Yeah. So I like the fact that we get back to that more of a spherical thing, because it feels more like an arena.
Well, everyone facing the view screen just makes sense, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I mean,
it seems weird to be facing in a totally different direction so you can't even see what's going on.
Yeah.
Especially definitely. Tactical. Tactical needs to face the view screen.
Yeah, like on the Enterprise, and remember on the Enterprise A, Chekhov, when he's firing torpedoes, he's like facing the wall to the sides. Like, you know, how do you, where's your reference frame? How do you?
And at least like Tuvok and Harry get little chairs, don't they? Because Worf never gets to sit down, bless him.
Poor Worf, still standing after all these years.
It's got to be terrible for his back, because that tactical console on Enterprise D is pretty far down. He's got to bend over a lot to fire. So he's always like hunched over like a hunchback. People, not whales.
Hunchback whales. They're humpback whales. Quasimodo
sanctuary,
In general, I think you're right. The Voyager bridge is more practical than the Next Generation bridge by a lot.
Oh yeah,
yeah, and I like Janeway's ready room as well, better than Picard's.
Oh, I love her ready room.
Yeah,
that takes up like a quarter of the volume of the entire ship.
It takes up quite a bit, doesn't it? But I love her ready room. I think it's awesome.
I love that there's a back door, so she can sneak out if she wants to.
Yes, she can sneak in and out.
Janeway's ready room is one of the most 1990s things that I see on the ship, actually, because it's got like the silver railing and the glass walls. It looks like some sort of like, you know, futuristic 1990s coffee table.
It does.
The whole thing, like the whole ready room looks like a big 1990s, you know, modernist, you know what I'm
or
talking about?
Restaurant.
Like this coffee table that have like the glass with a brass trim around it. It, you know, it's.
Yeah,
so
although
90s.
Picard's ready room looks like a reception somewhere.
Complete with the fish tank.
Yeah. He looks like a receptionist.
Yeah, like a doctor's office waiting room or something.
You just walk up there. Hi, I'm here for my appointment.
The doctor will see you now.
Exactly. I also find it interesting that I think Janeway's ready room is the only room we see that's actually bigger on Voyager than it is on the Enterprise.
That's true. All the rooms tend to be smaller, right? I think in general the color scheme is better on Voyager than on the Next Generation, I think, personally.
Oh, yes.
More gray, less beige.
From an interior design standpoint.
The Enterprise D kind of reminded me of, like, the Golden Girls. Just the colors.
Well, there's the running joke that it's the USS Hilton. It looks like, you know, inside of a hotel lobby.
Yeah, pretty much. It's very beige. I think gray's more practical. It's like, it'll show up the dirt less.
Seriously, I generally like the cooler color palette on Voyager, the greens and the blues and the grays and the silvers. And that's just a nice, you know, coherent color palette to me.
It's pleasing. Pleasing to the eye.
Mm. Whereas the Next Generation is weird. Next Generation, you kind of get beige mixed with like lavender, mixed with like mustard yellow. It's weird.
Yeah.
But that was the 80s, man.
Yeah.
You know what's also missing on Voyager? And this isn't really part of the ship, but it's part of the design of the ship. What's remember all those weird paintings of like space stuff on the Enterprise D? Like there'd be pictures of planets, or there's the one in Captain Picard's ready room of the Enterprise D kind of stylized going at warp. But there's a few of these just random space paintings or space photographs on the walls. So like there's like someone came in and designed, you know, maybe before the crew was ever on board, like as it was leaving Utopia Planitia. Do you think they like had someone like an interior designer had to pick out the art that's going to go on the Enterprise D? They didn't do that with the Voyager. There wasn't enough time. There's no art.
That was part of the art gallery. They had an art gallery. All of that was for sale.
On the Enterprise D? Of course they did.
Yes.
Of course they'd have an art gallery in the Enterprise D.
Yeah, that is true. They would.
How could you think they wouldn't do that, right?
They have a whatever you can think of on Data's the Enterprise.
Data's Mondrian paintings on the wall.
Yeah. They have an arboretum. They have an art gallery. Yeah. Why not? Sure.
But isn't it? It's conspicuous. There's no art on Voyager's walls that I can think of off the top of my head.
Just the stuff the crews put up in their quarters.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, people are going to hang their own stuff on their walls, sure.
Chakotay's sand paintings.
People tend to have more kind of artifacts and stuff rather than paintings, don't they? And Janeway's got a lot of books and stuff. Yeah, we don't see much art on the walls at all, do we, really?
Not that I can think of. It's an interesting difference between the Enterprise D and
maybe
Voyager.
That contributes to the different feel. I don't know, because there's definitely a different feel straight off from the art.
It's more utilitarian for sure. Yeah,
I think so. I think the Enterprise feels more relaxed. Not relaxed in the sense of like a lack of the usual discipline and all that type of thing, but it feels more relaxed in the sense of there's not this sense of, oh God, we're lost in the Delta Quadrant, obviously.
That's relaxing, yes.
It might actually just help reinforce the idea that Voyager was not supposed to be a deep space ship, right? It's supposed to be, which is weird because it's a faster ship, so you think it'd be more capable of reaching deep space than the bigger, slower ships, but so it doesn't really make sense. But it's like it's not supposed to be a long-term, multi-generational kind of ship out there, right? It's just supposed to do sort of short to medium range, high speed, you know, highly maneuverable mission.
Yeah, it was just supposed to be a 3-hour tour.
Am I right about this? Right? Yeah. Right. Exactly. It's a schooner. It's not a cruise liner, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That does help with that. It's interesting. I wonder if that was how much they thought about that, whether or not they thought about that much when they were setting this up.
Yeah.
Are there any other sort of noticeable differences that you guys can think of between The Next Generation in particular, but maybe the original series too, and Voyager? Because, I mean, Voyager started right at the end of The Next Generation and had to distinguish itself. It was a different ship, different group of people, different mission, different everything. So what are the kind of design choices that just lead to this different vibe of the ship?
It does feel smaller. Mm-hmm. It does feel like a smaller ship. Because I think as well with the Enterprise, throughout the run of the show, you know, there are times when you're getting into like the later seasons, into like season 5, 6, 7, etc., and you wouldn't be surprised to see a room that you'd never seen before because there are so many. Whereas that's never going to happen on Voyager. Yeah, okay, we get astrometrics because they build it later on, but.
But I guess it doesn't happen on The Next Generation either. They just talk about it. They just say, oh, there's 1,000 people on board. And you just kind of mentally believe that the ship is huge and there's all these rooms you've never seen. But they never actually show it very much.
They do show random rooms at times, though. There are times when they just randomly go, oh, here's
like the nursery.
Arboretum today or whatever. Or the nursery or the
nursery.
This or the that or whatever. That does happen.
Remember in Star Trek Generations, they show stellar cartography.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's believable that this giant room on board that you've never seen before and has this cool interactive map features. You're like, oh, okay, that's part of the Enterprise D. I've got it.
Yeah.
But Voyager, you don't expect that. You don't.
No.
There's no room.
No, exactly. But if they did randomly come up with a new place on the Enterprise for a story, you wouldn't be surprised. You'd be like, oh, yeah, like you said. Of course it's got an art gallery we have never seen.
They did come up with astrometrics, but they had to convert something to create astrometrics.
Didn't they convert stellar cartography?
Is that what it was?
Is that what it was?
Pretty sure, because
it makes sense.
There were a few people that worked in stellar cartography.
And what exactly is the difference between stellar cartography and astrometrics anyway? I mean, one implies we're just mapping stuff. The other one implies we can measure stuff.
It's just more advanced.
Better sensors, I guess. I just kind of picture it as this like souped up sensor array, like they're gathering massive amounts of data from really far away and they can synthesize it all together and show it to you on this cool screen. But
yeah,
why? I don't know why that's much different than what they could do in stellar cartography. But
it allowed them to see much further, didn't it? And map in much more detail.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was the writers going, yay, we have CGI now. Look at what we can do.
And we have a Borg. Perfect combination.
I really like astrometrics. It's one of my favorite things about Voyager.
Well, without astrometrics, you wouldn't have the totally epic Fortress Ovum scene.
Oh, I love that scene. Besieged! Besieged, I tell you!
Thousands of little warriors. it's actually kind of a Klingon speech. Little tiny warriors, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, it is.
Are there any other just little details? I mean, things that you love or hate about Voyager, things that just make you go, oh, Voyager, it's awesome.
We haven't talked about the landing thing and the blue alert. That's quite cool.
Yeah, we didn't talk about the landing thing. Yeah, Voyager can land, and that's cool. Okay, well, you know what I love about the blue alert? Everything science fiction in the late 70s and 80s and clearly into the 90s is blue. Like neon blue, like Tron, like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I mean, you know, blue glows, and you know, it's cool. Yeah. It's science. I'm all for the blue alert. They should have used that more.
Yeah, I really like the fact that Voyager can land. It's very cool. Although, how the heck it stands on those little tiny legs, I have no idea.
Those little tiny legs.
Yeah.
Back to the blue thing for just a second. Have you guys seen this thing that someone put together of all the different control panels that you see in all the different science fiction movies and TV shows and franchises, that the vast majority of them are blue?
Okay. I hadn't really realized that.
Blue is a futuristic color, apparently.
Well, isn't it easier on the eyes?
There are some exceptions. You see some green ones and red ones, but blue, no, blue is really hard on the eyes. That's why you have like blue blocker sunglasses and blue blocker computer glasses.
I'm blue, bada beat up, bada beat up.
Did we have anything more to say about the landing thing? It is cool, but we don't see it that many times, do we?
The one that I like it in Dragon's Teeth. That's when I think it looks really, because it's got that cool background. It just looks cool.
No, like two or three times.
Yeah. I think it might be a couple more than that. Basics. Mm-hmm. I love when we see it take off in Basics, when they, like, the Kazon run off with the ship.
The demon planet one.
Yes.
Yep. When Voyager lands on a planet and it's got its landing struts out, how does the crew get from inside Voyager to down on the planet? Is there like a little escalator?
I envision, like, you know, one of those emergency slides from airplanes. So slide down it.
like a water slide?
One of those inflatables, you know, you just slide down.
Don't they just beam?
Oh, sure.
Well, yeah, they could beam, but what if the transporter's out, right? What if they can't beam down? Do they just like take the Delta Flyer for
a really short ride? Well, we do see them walking around on the hull at one point, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Those little struts probably have a turbo lift inside them.
Like, do they rappel down or something?
I'm sticking with the slide.
I'm not sure that's
what are the different
ever
options?
Covered. I like the slide idea.
It's the most fun.
I guess it could be like a fireman sliding down the pole, like just grab onto the landing strut and slide all the way down.
Yeah. They have a greasy pole.
That'd be a long ride. Well, it's been fun talking about the Voyager. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
The ultimate fantasy was being called the ultimate fiasco, the ultimate fallacy, the ultimate F-up. And one girl on Sunday afternoon, she tells a story, they were walking to dinner, and she says, oh my God, you guys, they were talking some of these, you know, snarky names. She goes, no, you guys, listen, we've just survived the Con of Wrath. And they all like died laughing.
Warp 5.
At that time, you know, PTSD was not even a diagnosis. We had, for generations, had different terms to describe issues with soldiers' heart, you know, combat fatigue, shell shock.
Melodic Treks.
I have a big love in my heart. You know, like my top three episodes are Where No Man's Gone Before, Believe It or Not, The Alternative Factor, and The Lights of Zatar.
I just almost passed out.
Meta Treks.
For me, just as soon as Quark goes under the knife,
it is not essential Trek philosophy.
Something seriously goes wrong. Not for me, no.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and YouTube. Of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
Another way you can help keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, we'd like to thank the rest of the To the Journey team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And we'd also like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers for To the Journey, Bruce Lish and Ju Kim. We really appreciate your support of the Trek FM network and To the Journey.
And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, project of the non-profit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and get your seat on the mission. And also audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
If you'd like to get in touch with us to talk about anything we discussed in this episode of To the Journey, you can contact us in several different ways. You can find us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our To the Journey show page on the Trek FM website, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @TrekFM. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/TrekFM. And while you're on Facebook, find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type The Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click Discussion on the menu bar. And we also invite you to leave a rating and a review of To the Journey on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Kay, when you're not socializing your pet neural gel pack, where can people find you on the Trek FM network and around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference. And if you want to look me up on Twitter, my handle is Choco Weeble. So, Suzanne, when you're not getting 4,000 teradynes per second of output out of your tricyclic input manifold, where can people find you?
Well, you can sometimes find me on the Babel Conference. I'll pop up in there occasionally. You can also find me on Twitter at KJaneWay8. That's the letter K, Janeway, and the number 8. Zachary, if people would like to contact you and find out how exactly Voyager was able to stand up on those tiny little landing struts, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the Trek FM network as co-host of MetaTrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host there, Mike Morrison. You can always find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruling. And you can find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek with me there.
Be sure to join us next week when we will be traveling at warp 9.976. But until then, this has been To the Journey.